To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Seismically, things are very alive right now. And so our guest is Jim Berkland. And he is famous, or is it infamous, for predicting earthquakes that come true. We'll get back to him in a moment. So many things to talk about with Jim Berkland, but we were with animals, back sort of with the animals for a moment. Jim?
Yo.
How are you going to develop this thing with animals? Are you going to go further with it? I know now you watch, you know, the lost and found, the animals that run away, that sort of thing.
Yes, I have the daily records now since 1979 for a couple of newspapers, and so I can... if a quake comes up, I can demonstrate how the animals showed it before the World Series quake, which I named in the newspaper 4 days before it happened. Instead of having 4 or 5 missing cat ads, we had 27, the all-time record at that point. And we had 58 missing dog ads instead of the normal 15 or 20.
Well, you're doing that for that area, but I mean, if this is an effective method of forecasting earthquakes, then really it ought to be done just about everywhere, shouldn't it?
Well, sure, but I'm just one person. But I did predict a quake up in Seattle, the 5.7 quake on the southwest edge of Puget Sound the day before it happened, because there were an extraordinary number of missing animals in the Seattle Times. Back in 1990, I was invited to speak to the Foundation for the Study of Cycles in Irvine, California, on the 25th of it was February, 1990. And that morning, I pulled out the L.A. Times before my talk and saw 58 missing dogs, and the normal was about 20.
Mm-hmm.
So towards the end of my talk, I said, I want to save time for questions, but I also want to alert you to my concerns here based on this. And I unfolded this long line of missing pets. And I said, based on this, and the fact that my window is still open for 3 days, I'm predicting a 5-magnitude quake or greater for the Los Angeles area within 3 days. A fellow in the back of the audience got up and went out the door, and I never saw him again. 10 days later, I got a letter from New York saying, congratulations on another hit. I didn't want to share in it. I checked out a hotel and took the first plane back to New York. Now, he really took me seriously.
Obviously.
But the Upland quake hit on the 28th. And that did quite a bit of damage, about 30 miles north of where I was speaking. Interesting, too, as I was making this talk, it was all videotaped. And during my talk, there was an electronic glitch right across the middle of the screen that they couldn't understand. It didn't happen with any other speaker over 2 days.
Uh-huh.
But it, you know, people say this was just an anecdote. No, I did it in advance, and it's recorded. And just like the newspaper account or any other of these accounts that I give.
Well, I mean, here you are on national radio. It's you've already made one prediction, sort of a loose one, a 6 quake, I think you said,
in
my area, meaning Southern California, Southern Nevada, within 3 months.
During the 3 months of summer.
Is there anything else you'd like to predict now and get solidly on the record?
Okay, well, I just, all of my newsletter, and I've been sending out a newsletter monthly since I was on suspension for predicting the World Series quake, and they told me I could only come back to work if I didn't predict any more on county time.
Right.
So I started my newsletter in January of 1990, and my next window, and this window, by the way, is March 8th to 15th, So it closes tomorrow. So what's happened? Just this afternoon, there was a 3.5 down by Palomar.
Yes.
And that was 100% hit. There was a 3.3 at Olympia, and I set a 3 to a 5. So that was 100% hit. And I said there would be a 3.5 to 6 in the Greater Bay Area. And there was a 4.2 this afternoon over in, I guess it was yesterday, over in Mammoth Lakes. It was 30 miles beyond my 140-mile limit, so I give myself 70 or 80% for that.
Okay.
So anything beyond 30% off in distance would not count, or 3 days off doesn't count, and 3/10 magnitude off wouldn't count. I say I'm off the dartboard in that case.
That's pretty tight.
Yeah. Talked to some of my critics. One critic said 4 minutes off with a quake in Los Angeles a few years ago.
Yes.
That was a total miss. It happened at 11:56, and my window didn't open until midnight. So that's, and they want mathematical precision, and
well,
Mother Nature just won't be browbeaten like that.
Yes, of course. But, you know, critics are that way.
I have
critics,
noticed. When I went to that meeting, as I mentioned, Dr. Vladimir Kalas-Borok, and listened, and I got up and introduced myself, and said, the title of this meeting is, Have We Turned the Corner on Earthquake Prediction? Ladies and gentlemen, I didn't have to turn the corner because I've been on a straightaway for the last 30 years. Nobody reacted. And I said, the two quakes that Dr. Borok says he predicted and helped to establish this new prediction, I predicted both of those in my newsletter, and I have copies with me of the last, the 8 magnitude over in Japan and the 6.5 in San Simeon. Not one person approached me, and as I tried to hand a few out to people, they avoided me like I had the plague.
Really?
So I realized that's the status of science. Well, by the way, a lot of this may change because at long last there is a book being written about what I've been doing, and it's by author Cal Ori, who's written a lot about animals and has written short stories and items about animals and quakes, and often included me in Cat's World, Dog's World, Women's World. But this is a full-fledged book, and it's going to come out in December, and we will be distributing it. I had a table at the American Geophysical Union.
I wonder how that'll be accepted.
We shall find out.
You think more of the same?
No, because the scientists are one thing and the people are something else. I have received thousands of letters. Only one unfavorable letter in all the ones I've received. My first time on your show, I offered people a free newsletter.
That's right.
Send me a self-addressed stamped envelope. And you said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, sure.
That's right.
I got 4,000, and I spent the next 3 months tearing open letters and stuffing newsletters for people.
Well, I'm good at predicting that kind of stuff. yeah. Listen, there's something on the Drudge Report that I'd like to call your attention to if you haven't seen it. It's a picture of the top of Kilimanjaro. It says, the peak of Mount Kilimanjaro, as it has not been seen for 11,000 years, developing. What's that all about?
Well, apparently the global warming is happening. It's just not necessarily man-caused, but no question that we're losing a lot of ice. And we had a warmer period than this when the Vikings were going, my heritage, back in the 800 to about 1200. It was warmer than today.
Mm.
And that's why they settled on Iceland and Greenland and Vinland.
Well, surely when you look at the North Pole and you look at the South Pole and what's going on at both those places,
sure,
particularly up at the North Pole, and look at pictures separated by 40 or 50 years, it's really freaky. I mean,
yeah,
you know, 40% of the ice or whatever gone on the way to becoming a new sea that will be navigated by our Navy.
Yes. Well, I guess the Hemingway would have to rewrite his Snows of Kilimanjaro, huh?
Yes, apparently. That's incredible.
Yes.
Absolutely incredible. All right. Under the category, Jim, of how many died, when we have these earthquakes around the world and these tsunamis, the number of victims, the number of people that die, seems really hard to track. I mean, they always start off with a very few, and it's always a minimized story, and then by the time it's done, you're up to 100,000 people or something. How frequently are we being lied to, do you suppose, about how many people are killed in these?
About 90% of the time.
That's a lot of the time, Jim.
Yes. Well, I discovered in 1979 about the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco. I often raised the question, gee, we got awfully lucky. They're only losing a few hundred, 452 or 315 or 277. Various experts came up with different numbers, almost all less than 500 for San Francisco.
That's right.
And they said, well, absolutely, the fire did most of the damage, and people just moved out ahead of the fire. You didn't expect them to wait around. Well, I did if they were crushed under the buildings. The temperatures of that fire hit 2,500 degrees because cast iron melted. And radiators and kegs of nails were retained the shape of the keg, and the wood was all gone, the nails fused together. It takes 2,500 degrees. I checked with a crematory, and they only use 1,800 degrees. So there was very little to clean up. So the Army, the early estimates by the Telegraph Company and General Funston were about 3,000 killed.
Mm-hmm.
And then General Greeley came up quickly to take over, and the Secretary of Commerce and Labor, Metcalf, was a direct emissary from Teddy Roosevelt. And they all had their act together. It's just like you recorded. There has been much exaggeration of the death. The true total is, and pick a number from around 250 to 450. And people didn't want to deal with it because the Army had everything in control, and they claimed there hadn't been anybody shot for looting except one accidental one. Lies, lies, lies. And so I ran into an article in Great Disasters of the World by James Cornell, and it said that in 1968 this major quake hit Iran, and that at least 6,000 people died. There were reports that more than 18,000, but the truth will not be known because the reluctance of the Iranian government to admit to shoddy construction. I read that and said, that sounds logical. And then I read a British almanac, 1907, which said, last April 18th, San Francisco was visited by a frightful earthquake, caused more than 60 million pounds damage. Now, $5 a pound in those days, 300 million, not too far off the
right
real damage. But more lamentable was the loss of several thousand lives. Oh, my hackles rose on seeing that. What are these British mean telling us lost several thousand when I know for a fact it was only a few hundred? Come on. What, do they think we are a third world country? And I was very provincial.
I really have wondered about this tragedy toll that we get. Mm-hmm. It seems so strangely released. And
yes.
Sumatra, for example, I wonder what is real there.
Well, in my newsletter in January, I estimated 400,000 killed and would die with the disease and all. The highest total I've seen now is about 300,000, but it's slowly climbed. It's still occurring. The people are even killing each other. It's a desperate situation and maybe one of the world's greatest disasters. And they said the tsunami first reported about 30 feet, and now they found debris up on 80-foot trees, and they...
Oh, my God.
It was up to 80 feet in places.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And one of the most incredible things is a leading geologist whom I've met and did a lot of work on the San Andreas Fault. I didn't know he had worked 10 years in Sumatra. He was spending his own money distributing 5,000 posters and talking to churches and schools and trying to acquaint people to the threat of a big quake and tsunami. This is last year in July.
I think I'd heard about this.
Well, and I've been trying to include him in my book. Cal's been trying to get hold of him, but I don't know if he's been told to be quiet or what. But,
well, I've heard about this, that he was distributing all kinds of warnings.
Yes, and he had a meeting set up with some of the governmental leaders a couple of weeks before the event. And then they decided they didn't have enough money to travel, and they canceled it. But he did about what I did before the World Series quake. I took matters in my own hands because most of the media outlet didn't want to hear about that I'd been working with earlier.
Well, you must have known when you did that, Jim, that
yes.
you were doing a potentially career-ending thing.
It didn't end my career, but...
But, I mean, you had to look at it that way before you did it.
Yes.
That had to be one of the things that you considered.
Definitely.
You know, fallout.
I said, am I going to conform or am I going to inform?
Yes. Well,
and when if somebody had the clue to for AIDS or something, you have to come out with it. And I just don't believe in censorship. I was very fortunate as county geologist. There was only one time before the World Series earthquake where I was censored, and I was told to not talk about the threat of mudslides following the big forest fire we had in 1985. And I talked to the sheriffs and the Forest Service and the various homeowners, and finally I got the word from the boss, Jim, some of the real estate people are concerned it might affect property values.
Oh.
So we don't want you to talk about the potential for mudflows. Well, look, we had extremely heavy rainfall, and everything that I said happened. And so I got...
I was going to ask, what would the motive be for trying to shut you up, and you just told me?
Yeah, that's the same thing with the deaths in 1906. The insurance company said they weren't going to pay for any earthquake damage because nobody had any earthquake insurance. So early estimates of 50% went down to 95% fire and 5% earthquake. And all the old-timers through history called it the fire, not the earthquake. And only in recent years, the city historian, Gladys Hansen, was doing the same thing I was simultaneously back in the late 70s. She started after Roots appeared on television, and she was getting all these wires and phone calls from people all around searching for Aunt Gertrude. She'd look for Aunt Gertrude on the death list and the missing list, and she wasn't there. And so she realized eventually that there was a third list of those that never had been followed up upon. So in 1989, she and a former fire chief wrote a big card table book, picture book, wonderful pictures that they had on file with the fire department. And it's called Denial of Disaster. And in there she said at least 3,000 killed. Well, I've been saying 5,000 to more than 10,000 from 1979. And now it's starting to appear in some of the official books. But for many, many years, the World Almanac would say 452 dead.
See, it just doesn't seem as though 2,000 people or 3,000 people could be missing for that period of time without somehow somebody realizing that that's how they died and they're getting added to the death toll.
Well, just picture... if you live in another part of the country and your relatives visiting out here and they disappeared, you don't know what to do.
Right.
How do you follow up? And you get denials from everywhere. Well, they'll show up, or maybe they'll get back to you, and then time passes.
And they don't.
No. And I found a similar... Now, had I been the county or city geologist for San Francisco, and I hear Mayor Schmitz... Governor Pardee or Teddy Roosevelt say, Jim, terrible disaster. Do you think it could happen again in another 10 years? No. 50 years, not likely. 100 years, maybe. Well, it's a long time away, and we have to look to the present and to the living. We have to rebuild. We have to encourage reinvestment. It's the leading military, social, economic center of the West Coast. You've got 450,000 people lived in San Francisco, only 250,000 in Los Angeles at the time. So, I would have agreed to a time capsule, you know, in 20 years, 30 years, let the truth come out so we can prepare for the next one. What's the greater good, to keep it quiet for a while so that we could... Absolutely, the investors back east said no more. They had the big quake in 1892 and 1865 and 1868.
Right.
Right on down, so good money after bad. And people could accept fires because they had the big one in Chicago and Baltimore and best-run city can have a fire. So they focused on the fire and absolutely minimized the deaths. And that happened many, many other times in many other places. And I've started, you can graph it. It starts low, as you were saying, and then it steadily increases day after day, and then finally it gets sort of asymptotic. It kind of flattens out. Well, in the case of San Francisco, it started very high, and then we ended up very low, made a big L. And totally unrealistic. It hasn't happened, you don't see patterns like that.
There's something weird with these death tolls. Jim, hold tight. We're at the bottom of the hour. Jim Berkland is my guest. And we're talking about the earth below us. the earth that we all walk on. Have you ever been in a really big earthquake? As I said earlier, it is the most hard to deal with event you'll ever go through, because you have totally, absolutely no control over it whatsoever. None. It's going to happen to you.
Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Good morning. Jim Berkland is here. He predicts earthquakes. That's something a geologist is not supposed to do. Actually, maybe it is something a geologist is supposed to do. Maybe we ought to have a different way of thinking about that whole thing. What do you suppose? Would you? I am kind of a quake watcher, and of course I get communications, thank God, from all of you out there. And as a result, I'm aware of most quakes that occur, and certainly the unusual ones that occur. And Jim, lately I've been getting emails from people, and there are quakes going on at the North Pole.
Yeah, Severnaya Zemlya.
Yeah. How unusual are quakes at the North Pole?
They're pretty unusual, just like at the South Pole. We finally had a few years ago, there was an 8-magnitude quake way down near the Antarctic continent, which was almost unique. But most of the action is, you know, in the temperate zones and from there south.
The middle zones, right?
Yeah.
So if we do start having a lot of quakes at the pole, is there something about that that should concern us?
Well, I haven't really seen, you know, just an occasional one. I haven't seen a concentration of them up at the extreme latitudes. But if we did, then that would, you know, cause some additional concern about the magnetic fields. And
yes.
And the first work I had with the USGS was in paleomagnetic studies of the western lava flows. And back in the late 50s, they still thought they could explain the variations by changes bipolar wandering, that the magnetic field would wander, and they didn't accept plate tectonics. That was really not born officially till 1969.
Right.
So things change. I had to unlearn an awful lot of facts. What I have said finally when I teach, I say a scientific fact is at best a progress report, subject to change with some new insight or some new data.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Another area I want to ask you about is the sun. I watch the eruptions on the sun, and
yeah,
of course it has 11-year or 22-year cycles, depending on how you want to look at it. And I have, because of my hobby with ham radio, I've watched solar cycles very carefully and might see some correlation with what goes on in the sun. Anything there?
Big time. And 5 years ago, I would have scoffed at it. How can something on the sun affect earthquakes? There's no mechanism. Well, just look at the facts. Within 2 days of the World Series quake, there was a huge solar flare, an X-13.
Right.
And on the very day of the 6.2 Morgan Hill quake, there was an X-13. And on the day of the 7.4 at Eureka in 1980, there was an X-9.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw the list of the actual biggest solar flares and compared them with the known earthquake times, there was a huge correlation. So I have to say, it doesn't matter if I understand the mechanism. If I see the timing correlation, I'm going to say that it looks like there's a pattern. And I don't know what goes on when I turn on my television set. Just as long as I get a picture and a sound, I'm happy. So just as long as I see a correlation and I can make correlations into the future, make projections, and if I can be successful, then I accept that there's something going on.
All right. So if you don't mind, I'd kind of like to start into the phones and see what
people would
like to ask you. Good. All right. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Yes. I was wondering if Mr. Berkland is aware of the alignment of the planets that is supposed to happen on 5-5 this year on May the 5th.
Right.
I read a book by that title of May, 5-5-2005, probably 7-8 years ago, and it was predicting because of the gravitational fields and the way that they affect the Earth, that there could be a massive events happening on May the 5th.
All right, well, let's look into that. Sure, people have been talking about that forever, and some people would say the other planets have so little gravitational effect that line up any way they want. It doesn't compare much to, for example, the effect of the moon. What do you say, Jim?
Al, you're so right. I would have kept an open mind on it, but when you have all the other planets, the tide-raising force varies with the cube of the distance, and it varies with the mass and the cube of the distance, and so these planets are out so far that really planets and stars have no effect on our crust. Now, if there's something magical, astrological, then it ought to work. I mean, if that worked, we would see it. I have yet to have an astrological prediction come true, but I've had a number of post-dictions. People say, oh, yeah, we could have predicted that because Uranus is twined Jupiter or something. But if you combine all of the gravitational forces from the rest of the planets, they'd be less than 1,000th the effect that the moon has. So unless we're looking for a trigger on a trigger, it's just not there. So I don't worry about that 5-5-5 thing at all.
With regard to your colleagues, somebody fast blasted me that it was jealousy. With regard to the way they treated you, Jim, now, do you think jealousy is at the core of it with regard to your making predictions, or do you think that something else... just sort of a piling on professional...
I would be happy if it were just jealousy. I know about 5 years ago, a lovely young gal was doing a television program on earthquakes and earthquake predictions. She said,
yes,
Jim, I'd like you to be on, and I'd like you to be on with people from Berkeley and Stanford and Hayward State and USGS. And I said, it's fine with me, but you may have a problem at the other end. She said, I don't think so. 3 days later, she called me and said, Jim, I've never seen such animosity in my life. They refuse to be on the same timely. It's the same show with you.
Well, I was about to say, is it a piling on of ridicule, just sort of piling on, or what's going on?
Well, back in, I mentioned I missed that first one in April of 1976, the first time I went public, and said, call me back in October. And as long as I missed, there was no problem. But then when I hit a doubleheader on the first day of my October window on the day of the eclipse, that's when heavy hitters came in.
Yeah, I can see that, of course. In other words, if you miss, you just sink to the back of the,
sure.
You know, and then out from sight altogether. But if you hit, then you become a target.
Very much so. And then in 1990, I was written up in the Wall Street Journal. And, of course, they went to USGS for comments, and one of the geologists said, we've known this fellow for his entire career, and he's been nothing but a clown. Now, I'm listed in who's who in America and who's who in science and technology and a bunch of other who's who's, and I'm a fellow in the Geological Society of America and a member of the Association of Engineering Geologists and Earthquake Engineering Research Institute and on and on and on. And so I'm not a clown at all. And that was a little too much. Well, I was still a county geologist, and they're demeaning me like that. So I went to Pete McCloskey, an attorney, and he wrote them a letter. And they got off my back. It cost me a bundle, but it was worth it.
Maybe you're nothing but a heartache for them.
I think so. And it's really unfortunate, because for the first 5 years, knowing that I'm not a seismologist nor a geophysicist, I went hat in hand to those professions in a box full of information and said, would you look at this? No, we don't have time for that, Jim. We have our own studies.
All right, then if not jealousy, what? Put a word to it. What is it?
They are concerned about their own budgets. I'm a threat to their credibility. When they missed on the Parkfield earthquake.
Boy, they missed big on Parkfield.
And you know when it actually occurred? Last September 26th was the day of the full moon. I thought that was most ironic. But it was about 6 years late. And they lost one-third of their geologists and almost lost their West Coast headquarters, which would have been a really crime. I really think the USGS is the finest scientific body in the world.
Why don't they think your body's so great?
I worked for them for 6 years.
Right. But why?
I really enjoyed it. A fantastic experience. And really had thought I would be able to work, you know, closely with them for my entire career. And that was true until they started predicting earthquakes. And even my best friend, I went to high school and Berkeley with back in the late 70s, he said, Jim, come on, what are you doing here? Why don't you predict some big quakes? And I said, well, we're not having big quakes. You know, why don't I predict quakes for around the world? Well, I actually tried that in my newsletter for 50 tries. I took what I called a monthly outright seismic speculation. I just looked at the map or just looked for a hunch.
Yes.
I hit 4 out of 50. But the one that I hit was really almost spectacular. We took a trip to Egypt, toured up the Nile, and the day we arrived, I was in the shadow of the pyramids and saw a fellow reading Al-Aram. And I had predicted in my newsletter we would have a 4.5 quake or better in Egypt while I was there, the 10 days I was there.
Yes.
And I mentioned, I'm looking to see if you have an earthquake. And his eyes widened up, and he pointed on the front page. They just had a 5.5 the day we arrived.
Huh.
So that was a hit, but it was, you know, pure luck.
So you're really best off when it comes to actual predictions, predicting for the area where you can gather the information,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, exactly.
Yes.
And you use the whole battery. You don't. Anything that works, use it. You don't have to understand it even. Now, I've done, you know, scuba diving in Hawaii and Virgin Islands. And when you see the fish down there and they suddenly change direction.
Yes.
100, 200 fish change instantly and they don't bump into each other. Same thing with a flock of birds.
Yes.
How do they do that? It has to be electrical. Now, when I had a bobcat as a pet, I was with the U.S. Geological Survey. He used to go in traffic and drive down there with me. And when I'd leave him home, my mother would always say, Jim's coming home. Put on the coffee or reheat the dinner. He's coming home at irregular hours, irregular days. she would know I was coming home because the bobcat would get up and wait by the front door. And I debunked it. I just didn't want to, my mom, what does she know? She's not a scientist. It can't be.
Oh, it's been well proven.
Now it's well established.
Yes.
In fact, I met the author of Pets Who Know When Their Owners, Dogs Who Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home.
That's right.
And he was at a meeting here in the little town of Sonoma, a book signing about 5 years ago. And I was sitting back in the audience of about 30, 40 people, and a question arose after he finished talking. They said, well, what about this story about animals being able to predict earthquakes? And he said, well, the one person that I know that's most advanced in that is Jim Berkland.
Right.
And I raised my hand and said, how do you do?
Parkfield. Go back to Parkfield for
yes.
a moment. They really stuck their neck out on that.
Yeah.
Now, what can you tell me? I would love to know. What information they based that prediction on. And I'd also love to know a little of the politics that went into making the decision to publicly make that prediction.
Oh, well, that was a huge political decision, yes.
I bet.
It happened in 1966. There were a pair of 5.5 magnitude quakes at Parkfield, and I was in Coalinga and got jostled by both of them. In fact, I was writing a letter to my wife-to-be at the time.
Yes.
Drove me out of the motel, and we all exchanged, that was quite a shake, and then we went back inside, and another 20 minutes, we're outside again.
But this particular prediction, Jim, how did they make that?
Well, they knew that in 1966 it had happened, in 1934 it had happened, in 1922 it had happened, 1901, all the way back to 1857. So about every 22 years, they were getting a 5.5 to 6.5 magnitude quake there.
So this was historical information?
22 years. But they had to ignore the fact that in 1922 to 34 was only 12 years.
Huh.
But then from 34 till 66, if you added the 12 years and the 30 years, you get the 44 divided by 2, you get 22 years.
So you're telling me they made this just on historical information?
Yes. They said, well, if the fault is increasing strain at a given rate, it should slip every so often. And sure enough, it seemed to do that here. So they put instruments from all kinds and drilled holes and brought in the international crews there waiting to catch that earthquake.
Did they see changes in their instrumentation that indicated it was on the way?
A few false alarms. And while I was back east on the Bill Cosby show, they slipped the paper underneath my hotel, and it said that the quake had happened. They actually had a 4.5.
Right.
And that was not big enough, but they thought maybe that's a foreshock. And so it was, great interest in the 6-magnitude quake finally coming. But now I understand, with all the instrumentation that's still there, there were almost no clues that anything was up last September, except what was up was the full moon.
What was the politics like behind the Parkfield prediction?
Well, they had to justify a budget. They'd known that the Chinese had predicted a quake in 1975.
So
evacuated the city of Haicheng.
Was a prediction gap?
Yes, yes. And so, and then here's another one. This one really crossed me. They tried to do what the Chinese did with a program called Earthquake Watch.
Yes.
And I was a member for 3 years, a 4-year program. And if your pet or wild animal or farm animal did something really weird, you'd assign it a 3 or a 4, and you would call in immediately on the hotline given to you. If it's just a 0, 1, or 2, you'd just sort of fill it in and turn in the monthly report. Well, on September 7th, 1980, I saw 3 things that really made me react. One, we had the most missing cats of the entire year, only 14 ads, but that was still most of the year. We had the new moon, and the previous new moon had resulted in 25,000 deaths in Algeria, and the previous full moon had resulted in 300 deaths in southern Mexico. So we're up to the next syzygy, the new moon on the 7th. And then the third factor, I called Olga Kolbeck over at the Geyser, Calistoga Geyser, the only geyser in California.
Yes.
And I'd known that the geyser was slowing down its eruption cycle prior to Northern California quakes. So on that noontime, I called her from my office and said, Olga, these things are happening with the cats and the tides. What's happening with your geyser? Jim, we're about to phone you. This morning it didn't erupt for 3 hours and 12 minutes instead of the normal 40 minutes. That was the all-time record and still stands. And I said, oh, it looks like a big one in Northern California. I'm going to call the USGS and predict it. She says, if you don't, I'm going to.
Oh.
So I immediately called the hotline. I said, based on these three separate factors, I'm calling for a 6.5 or better in Northern California within a week. Time, place, magnitude. We hadn't had a 6.5 for 14 years.
When you call USGS, who do you talk to?
Well, this was an automatic tape line.
Ah, so you left a message.
Tape recorded. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay. And so at the end of the year, in the previous 2 years, I'd gotten a transcript of my hotline calls. In 1981, I didn't get my 1980 calls. Along about July, I said, did you send those out? Oh, you should have had them long ago. So I'll look into it. Nothing happened. So in August, I called again. Oh, yeah, I meant to check on that. Then I got 9 of my 10 calls, and the 9 calls were just saying the dogs howled all night, or some fellas told their cat were doing strange things. I didn't make any predictions except that one time. Let them draw their own conclusions.
Do you still call USGS?
But you know what happened?
What?
They said they lost that tape.
They lost the tape?
It was mailed all the way from Menlo Park to Palo Alto, you know, which have you could spit across the boundary.
Well, maybe they had to send it to Rosemary Woods.
They said, we have a tracer on it. Sure, a year later, they still had a tracer on it. They thought they destroyed the evidence. But I had a letter written by my assistant who was on the extension phone, and he knows what went on.
All right. Birkeland and the USGS, who is he? Nothing but a heartache. Good morning, everybody. I'm Art Bell.